All right, welcome back to the Third String Podcast feed. This is the baseball show Full Count, and we have a lot of great content on the Third String feed lately. Just today, in fact, earlier today, Eshan and Taylor put up a Takes of the Game podcast talking about watchability ratings on the, I think it's the top five watchability indices for NBA teams this upcoming season. So definitely take a look at that, Takes of the Game. But this is Full Count. We're doing a baseball podcast. We've been kind of dominated by football lately. So just last weekend, Pete and I did some predictions for the weekend of NFL action. They did not go well, but Pete and I are here to try to redeem ourselves. Joined by Eshan, fresh off his Takes of the Game podcast, a master of all trades here. Eshan, Pete, welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be back. Hey, did you say indices? Is that really the plural of index? I had no idea.
Yeah, well, let me defer to the economist among us. Yeah, indices. INDICES, right, Eshan?
Yeah, that's right.
Impressive. Learn something new every day on Third String.
There you go. Well, let's learn something new about the National League playoff race here. I'm looking at MLB playoff odds, and this late in the season, with only a handful of games remaining, most of these playoff contests are decided. So we know that the Red Sox are in. They have clinched the AL East. We know the Yankees are in. They've clinched a wild card. We know the Indians are in. We know the Astros are in. We are pretty darn sure the Athletics will get in. There's an infinitesimally small chance that the Mariners, basically, if they win out and the Athletics lose out for the rest of the season, the Mariners could squeak in there. But there's a 0.6% chance, according to Fangraphs, that the Mariners make it in. So pretty much what I'm saying is the AL is decided. What's a lot less clear is the NL picture. The NL East is pretty clear. The Braves have a 97.2% chance, and the Phillies are 6.5 games back. So there's, I guess, always a chance. You know, you're saying there's a chance that they could sneak into the playoffs. Exactly. Thank you. But the Braves are going. The Cubs are almost certainly going to get in. The Brewers also sitting. They're only 2.5 games back of the Cubs, but 3 games ahead of the Cards. So they're looking like they're in a good position. And then it gets interesting after that, because the Cardinals are sitting, like I said, 3 games behind the Brewers. And then you move to the NL West. The Cardinals right now sitting at 550, which is the same winning percentage as the Dodgers, who are leading the NL West. And then a half a game behind them are the Rockies. So it basically looks like the Brewers and either the Rockies or the Dodgers are going to be jockeying for position in the wild card race there. And how do you guys see this shaking out? What's your prediction for what's going to happen here? Who's going to get left out in the cold of those teams?
I have no idea. I feel like making predictions about 10 baseball games is kind of a fool's errand. I'm going to say that the best thing that could happen for the Cubs is a 4-way tie between the Dodgers, Rockies, Brewers, and Cardinals. So there's a whole bunch of playoff games that have to happen in addition to the wild card game, and everyone uses up all their best pitchers that week before the division series starts. So,
right.
I'm just going to go ahead and call it 4-way tie between the Rockies, Dodgers, Brewers, and Cardinals. Brewers would have to fall back a few games for that to happen, obviously.
Yeah, well, let me, I just found the 538 playoff predictions that you were mentioning, Eshan. So the Cubs are not at 100% on 538, but they are at greater than 99%. So while they have not officially clinched, they've all but clinched. And the Brewers are at 98%, so similarly high. The Cardinals at 68, the Rockies at 47. And that is pretty actually similar to Fangraphs. Fangraphs has the Cardinals at 68 and the Rockies at 43.1.
They've converged a lot towards the end of the season.
Yeah, and I think that's natural. I mean, like as things grow more certain, I think the models will more naturally converge. The Dodgers are at 85% in the 538 standings and 88.8% in Fangraphs. So
I gotta say, it's wild to me that at the time we're recording this, right before their game has their first pitch in a few minutes here, the Dodgers are half a game up on the Rockies, tied in the loss column, and they're playing them today and tomorrow. So the idea that Fangraphs and 538 both think they have a 74%, you know, 70 high 70s chance to win the division, basically, when they're roughly tied with 10 games left, seems like too optimistic. Although Kershaw's pitching tonight, maybe that's priced in.
Perhaps.
I wonder if the Trevor Story injury is playing into that as well. I think I saw he's due back here in a couple days, but that injury seemed to kind of shake that franchise a little more than we expected as well in Colorado.
Yeah, although I did see, like you said, he's due back because the MRI came back clean, so the whole Rockies franchise is rejoicing.
What's going to be interesting, especially about the Cardinals versus the Dodgers over the next week and a half, is both of these teams have a pretty brutal schedule when you look at playoff teams. I mean, obviously, Eshan, as you pointed out, they got one game tonight against the Rockies. Wednesday, they'll play the Rockies. Should be a light weekend playing against the Padres, and then Arizona, and then a light weekend again against the Giants with their old rival. That's for the Dodgers. The Cardinals, on the other hand, have to play not only the Giants this week, but they also have the Cubs and the Brew Crew. So we could still see a lot of movement here. If either of these franchises drops 2 out of 3 series, they're going to be in a world of hurt. So I agree that the prediction game is pretty kind of out in left field right now. We just don't know how this is going to go. Are either of these teams passing the eye test in terms of who's hot right now? Are both teams hot, do you guys think?
Wait, both out of who? The Brewers are on fire.
Well, the Cardinals or the Dodgers. I think we can all agree that the Brewers are sitting pretty good right now, I'd say.
Cardinals or the Dodgers? The Cardinals I would not classify as hot. I would say that they're kind of muddling along.
Opposed to the Dodgers, you'd say the Dodgers are the better-looking team right now?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, so the Dodgers are 6-4 in their last 10. The Cardinals are 5-5. I mean, that's pretty much a wash to me.
Rockies are 5-5 also.
Right. So I think all of these teams, like none of them appear to be surging down the stretch. They're all sort of kind of, yeah, like Eshan said, middling along on their way to the end of the season.
I mean, a somewhat related thing I just want to bring up is that it is crazy to me how much instability there is in the bullpens of all of these teams. The Dodgers basically feel like they can't trust anyone to get an out, including Kenley Jansen, who's been pretty much terrible, giving up a ton of home runs since he came off the disabled list. The Rockies, of course, had multiple demotions from closer. Wade Davis had some really bad stretches. Ottavino's kind of getting the job done now. The Cardinals have been all over the place at the back of the bullpen. The Cubs just today, an hour ago, found out that Brandon Morrow's out for the season. Who previously they thought he might return today or tomorrow. And then Pedro Strop hurt his knee, and he's out until at least the beginning of the playoffs. He might try to pitch in the last regular season game as a tune-up for the playoffs. So basically, their two best relievers are hurt. So the Brewers kind of have a huge advantage over these other teams with their stability of Hader and Jeffress able to cover like 3-4 innings a game in the playoffs at really, really extremely high strikeout rate and high quality of pitching.
Yeah, I saw a stat today that the last 13 batters that Hader's faced have all been struck out. So his last 13 outs collected are all strikeouts, and his career high is 14. So he's one away from his career high on that. But to have a pitcher like him who is peaking at this point in the season, and he's been good all season, so it's not like this is new. But yeah, I mean, Eshan, you're right. He's not wearing down as the season goes on. He's getting better, and the fact that they can rely on him in their bullpen is huge.
What's the story with the back of the Braves bullpen, kind of looking ahead towards the playoffs a little bit and comparing these teams? Looks like Aradis Vizcaino and AJ Minter are their leaders in saves. I know Johnny Venters has been really good at the end of games from them. He hasn't pitched that much this season. I think he must be recently off the DL. Anyway, we can talk about something else. I just wasn't sure about the Braves, but out of the other teams in the playoff hunt, everyone's got so much instability at the back of the bullpen, except the Brewers, for whom the bullpen is a super strong strength. So to the extent the bullpen's become more important in the playoffs these days, certainly advantage Milwaukee there.
Well, and in a one-game playoff, I mean, the Brewers' bullpen is the one you want on the backside. So the Brewers are going to be able to, I think, set themselves up nicely here over the last 3 to 4 days of the season in order to make sure that they're ready for that one-game playoff. So I agree. I think the Brewers are kind of the team to beat to solidify your playoff status and get into the playoffs. But man, they look pretty solid for that one game playoff and potentially beyond.
You know, we haven't talked about AL at all because, like I said, all those races are decided. But I think we have to give a little bit of love to the Oakland Athletics, who, barring a last minute complete collapse, will get a playoff spot as a second wildcard team. And it's just super impressive for a team that by total payroll is only $80 million. That's good for the third bottom in the league, ahead of the Chicago White Sox and the Rays. So $80 million total payroll for the Athletics. Compare that with $228 million for the Red Sox, or $196 million for the Dodgers, $193 million for the Cubs. I mean, what Billy Beane has been able to do with this club is really impressive. And they sort of just snuck up on us all mid-season because we were all focused on the Mariners gunning for that spot. And, you know, all those narratives about how lucky the Mariners were getting, all the one-run games that they were winning, we kind of didn't see the A's sneaking up until after the All-Star break. And then all of a sudden, oh, they're here, and there's the Mariners regression to the mean, and now the Oakland Athletics are here to stay. So really impressed with what Billy Beane's been able to do in Oakland. I think I'm going to be rooting for this team because they're going up against these behemoths in the American League, like the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Astros, of course, who are the ninth highest payroll in baseball. And it'll be really fun to see a David versus Goliath story play out in the AL side.
I mean, honestly, if you asked me, like, even in mid-April, once we were like a month away from our baseball podcast previews and I hadn't been looking at the rosters to name more than like three or four players on the A's, I'm not sure I could have off the top of my head. It's
right.
Crazy.
Exactly.
What they've done.
Yeah, I mean, basically Matt Chapman and Sean Manaea, I think, were the two names that most stood out to me. And Matt Chapman, just because he's the best defender in all of baseball. But apart from that, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it reminds me of Moneyball. I mean, not to get too cliche about it, but I think what they are is an ensemble of solid players who aren't your like Giancarlo Stanton or JD Martinez level of stars, but are productive enough to give you the winning season that you need.
Yeah, I just read an article actually about how their success is kind of attributable to like the development or like the new age of Moneyball in many ways. And I don't remember exactly what the article was saying about what they value relative to other baseball teams. And obviously, it's just so much harder now to get the Moneyball type of edge now that all the teams basically have that kind of data and are utilizing those sorts of advanced analytics. But certainly, like launch angle, they've been at the frontier of the launch angle revolution in this article I was reading.
Or spin rate for the pitchers.
Yeah. And like you look at their home runs, I mean, I guess there's five guys on their roster with at least 20 home runs this year, and that doesn't even include Kanha, who's got 16 and 347 at-bats. So they're taking these guys like Piscotty, Jed Lowry, Chapman, guys who weren't necessarily known as big power hitters are now hitting a bunch of home runs despite playing in that huge pitcher's park in Oakland.
Yeah, totally. And Jonathan Lucroy, too, who's had a good bounce back season after his down year last year. Another guy, too, and we talked about this a few months ago when we were talking about how Mike Trout just keeps such a low profile for being such an outlier in the sport who's clearly the best in the game. And we attributed that in part to the West Coast effect. And, you know, just like the Pac-12 after dark, you know, just like Bryce Love gets overlooked for what he did last season at Stanford.
I appreciate that shout out.
I thought you would, Ishan. I thought you would. But that's the case, right? We talked about that with Bryce Love, too. Like, the athletes on the West Coast, because they play many times after people on the East Coast fall asleep, they don't get the same respect and appreciation. And I feel like the same is true of Chris Davis, who has put together so many, perennially hitting well for average and really well for power year after year after year. And again, this year has quietly put together a really good caliber season playing for the Athletics.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, Chapman, too. He's been incredible.
I love Chapman. Yeah, he's so much fun to watch. I was really bummed that Chapman got snubbed for the All-Star game and hopeful that he makes it in next year.
Baseball update, since this is a baseball podcast. Anthony Rizzo just had a Brandon Belt-like at-bat, 18 pitches long on a full count, and finished it up with a 108-mile-an-hour line drive back up the middle with a runner at third. Unfortunately, the line drive was caught on a dive by Nick Ahmed. So,
wow.
Bad end to an epic at-bat by Rizzo. But then Javier Baez came up and hit a two-run homer to right center. So,
of course he did, yeah.
Didn't feel that bad.
Not surprising.
Well, so to circle back to the A's real quick, just before we move off that topic, just another plug for Sin City. The Las Vegas 51s just became the AAA affiliate for the A's. So this town has been a buzz talking about the Oakland Athletics. And right now, as the buzz is building, people actually think that they might have a chance at catching the Yankees. I think it's still a little far-fetched right now, but we're pretty excited out here in Las Vegas to talk about the Oakland Athletics and see some of their AAA affiliates. Because, you know, we've had the Mets for a long time out here. And the Mets, with how bad they've been the last year, year and a half, there hasn't been a whole lot of talent living in their minor leagues right now. So we're excited about the Oakland Athletics out here as well.
You might say the Mets are the Buffalo Bills of the Major League Baseball.
Remember when that used to be the Cleveland Browns who we made fun of? Man, what a difference a year makes.
You know, here's the thing, though, back more serious note on the A's catching the Yankees. Does it really matter? I mean, all that means, right, is that the Yankees come to Oakland for the one-game playoff, right?
So in general, I think that home field advantage doesn't have a huge impact in a one-game playoff situation in baseball. But one interesting thing I was reading is that it could have an impact. It's not clear which team it helps, but the Yankee Stadium is just a lot more friendly to home runs than the Coliseum. But both teams are pretty home run reliant. So I guess not really sure which way that goes. I guess the other thing is bigger outfield in Oakland. So who's got better outfield defense or quicker outfield? Not really sure what the answer to that question is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. That's a good question. I'll have to look that up while we're talking about the next thing, which is, well, let's keep it American League. And let's go American League Rookie of the Year. I've seen some debate on my Twitter timeline the past couple weeks debating Rookie of the Year. There are a few leading candidates, but the names that I'm seeing tossed around the most are Shohei Ohtani, of course, who is the two-way phenom from Japan, who played in 102 games this season in some capacity, either as a pitcher or a hitter. And Miguel Andujar, who played in 137 games as a hitter. Obviously not a pitcher. Ohtani has compiled 2.8 WAR. Andujar has compiled 2.3. What are your guys' thoughts on who deserves the nod more between these two?
Sure. So as I'm looking at these two, I mean, two exciting players, which is exactly what the sport of baseball needs. For me, however, you guys know how I felt about Ohtani from really the day he came up, and I think he's just been such an exciting and dynamic guy. Living here on the West Coast, I watch a lot more Angels games than I used to. And even though he hasn't played nearly as much as we were hoping he would, I have really enjoyed seeing what Ohtani's been doing. And just the way he stacks up right now, I think if we factor only the pitching or only the hitting, it would be a pretty easy debate. But when I combine those two and the dual threat that he brings, I think it's got to be Shohei Ohtani right now. I mean, you're looking at, he's got over 60 strikeouts, over 50 innings, which I know isn't great. He's got a 3.3 ERA, but he's throwing over 100 miles an hour. He's got a low contact percentage, something like 65%, which I think is better than Chris Sale or Blake Snell or Max Scherzer. I mean, he's had not a ton of starts. I think he only had 10 or 11 actual starts this year before the news came out about Tommy John, but he had 5 quality starts in there. And then you look at what he's done in terms of hitting. He's got over a 10% walk rate. He's got 18 or 19 home runs right now. And he also has something like 200, 250 less plate appearances than most of the other rookies you're looking at around the league. So I think if you can, as a baseball writer, eliminate the time that he's been out for injury, which is unfortunately a factor here, but if you can eliminate a lot of that injury time and you look at what he's been able to do when he's actually on the field, to me, it's Shohei Ohtani. And I think you have to also factor in the excitement that this guy has generated and how much fun it has been to watch him play and what he's done there in a franchise that shouldn't need any kind of extra boost of excitement with Mike Trout, Albert Pujols. We look at all the star power that we keep seeing walk through the Angels organization, just an inability to turn around and make that something. I look at Ohtani. I'm not sure he'll be the guy to save the Angels franchise, but I look at the excitement he's pumped into that organization, and I am still all in on the Ohtani hype train.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it would be a travesty for Ohtani not to win. I mean, he's doing something no one's done in 100 years in baseball, which is be simultaneously elite on offense and on the mound. And, you know, if you were answering the question, which guy would you take for the next decade? The answer would be Ohtani. If you were answering the question, which guy's season will you remember the most in 10 years? The answer would be Ohtani. If you were answering the question, who would you take for one game today? It would be Ohtani. Probably even if you just had to choose him on offense versus Andujar. And Andujar, if I have this correctly, his defense has been much maligned this season. Is that right?
That is right. Yes. So both of them are defensively below average, but Andujar is worse than Ohtani.
Wait, has Ohtani played the field? I thought he just DH'd and pitched the whole season.
I thought he did as well, but he has a defensive rating on FanGraphs.
Is that just his defensive rating as a pitcher, though?
No, because this is his stats as a batter, as a position player batter.
Interesting, because I'm looking at the StatCast leaderboard for outs above average in the outfield, and I set the minimum opportunities to 5, and Ohtani doesn't show up.
Has 0. Okay.
So he's not caught even 5 balls in the outfield this season.
I don't know. I'll dig on that. But let me ask you guys this. So I agree with you on the Ohtani versus Andujar discussion as far as that goes. But and that's because Ohtani, you guys, I think, made most of these points already. But Ohtani in less games and in 235 less plate appearances has only 4 less home runs, a higher walk percentage, a higher ISO, which is slugging minus average, a higher slugging, a higher on base percentage by almost 40 percentage points, a higher WOBA, also significant, 402 to 360, and a higher WRC plus. So to me, the difference is not close, and that's good for 2.8 WAR. And on top of that, his pitching has compiled 1 WAR, and that's even taking into account the fact that he was laid up for a lot of the season with injury, and now has to go under the knife for Tommy John. But the question is,
can we just reference that he was? It was announced he had to have Tommy John surgery, and he went out that night and hit a home run.
Yeah, he was like, I'm gonna at least finish out the season as a batter. And I really like his approach because he basically said, I'm only gonna get better if I keep seeing pitching and keep getting reps. So I have to do that. But my question is, and I had the same kind of concern when Ichiro came over. I'm a huge Ichiro fan. But is it right to judge these professional players from Japan as true rookies in the same way that Andujar is a real rookie? Because I think
there's 2 answers to that question. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go for it.
Were you done? I mean, I think there's like a broader answer to that question, which is it always right? And there's an Ohtani specific answer. And I think it's possible, whatever your opinion is on the broader question of whether the players who have been professionals in Japan should be counted as rookies, like Ohtani's 23. So it's not like he's played a full career in Japan and he's coming over as an established 28-year-old or something.
He doesn't already have 1,000 hits in Japan or whatever.
Yeah, so it seems like treating him as a rookie is, you can think he should be treated as a rookie even if you think that Ichiro shouldn't have been.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. So I agree with that. My own position, I think, on this is I agree with Ohtani for Rookie of the Year because whether or not I think he should be a rookie is kind of immaterial because he is classified as a rookie per the rules, and the Rookie of the Year award is supposed to go to the most outstanding rookie, and it's not up to me to define what is a rookie. So it's almost like a meta question that is more abstract than the Ohtani discussion and shouldn't have bearing on the Ohtani discussion. So I still settle on Ohtani.
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's shift to the National League. Do you guys think that it should be Ronald Acuna for the Braves or Juan Soto for Pete's Washington Nationals or someone else, maybe Harrison Bader for the Cards?
I'm struggling with this one because Juan Soto is so much fun to watch, but you look at where the Braves are and what Acuna has done for the Braves. Unfortunately, I think it has to go to Acuna. And Juan Soto is getting a lot of credit because he's doing a lot of good stuff in Washington on a club where I really and truly believe, regardless of what the stat says, he has won them at least 4 to 5 ball games with just clutch performances in the field or bottom of the 8th home runs. He's really been important to them. But as I look at what Acuna's doing and I look at where we start to compare kind of the tangibles versus the intangibles, I mean, it's difficult with these two guys. The plate discipline from both of them is fantastic. You look at the walk rates. I think people forget Acuna is 20. Juan Soto gets a lot of credit for being 19. Acuna is only 20 right now, and he has this incredible speed on the base pass where I don't know if he's been thrown out in the last 2 months, honestly. And you look at his walk rate, you just look at his overall presence at the plate and then his solid fielding to back it up. Right now, I'm leaning towards Acuna based on where the Braves are versus where the Nationals are. But overall, I think if we go back to the questions you asked Ishan about who's the guy who I'm going to remember in 10 years, obviously I'm a Nationals fan, so that skews it. But I think both of these guys are incredibly exciting to watch, and this could really be a great race between these two in the NL East. So leaning towards Acuna, but I'm really, really close and trying to account for my bias towards Juan Soto.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like there's no wrong answer here. They both had such incredible seasons at such young ages. I'm going to give the slight edge to Acuna because I think he's been approximately as valuable, maybe a little bit more valuable on offense. They have like the same weighted on base percentage. Acuna's, I guess they have the same like wins, weighted runs created plus too. But Acuna, I think, is a little bit more valuable as a base runner and a little bit more than a little bit more valuable in the outfield. I've got his outs above average for the season is plus five on Baseball Savant, and his, whereas Soto's is minus five. So he's kind of like a top third of the league outfielder, where Soto's maybe around the edge of the bottom third. So I think there's like some tiebreakers, the defensive and base running, but their bats have been pretty similar in overall value. It's really impressive. Soto's 16.5% walk rate versus 20% strikeout rate. That's definitely his biggest edge on Acuna. He's got a 25% strikeout rate and a 9% walk rate.
Yeah, I think I can't remember a Rookie of the Year race that was more close than this. I mean, the two are within 12 plate appearances of each other. They have similar home run numbers. Acuna has the edge there. Soto has the edge on walk rate and strikeouts. Acuna's better on the ISO. Soto has a better average and on-base percentage and WOBA, but just by a hair. And Soto has a better WRC plus, but just by one, 151 to 150. But Acuna is a slightly better base runner based on Fangraph's metric, 3.2 to 2.7. So it really is neck and neck. And I think there is, like you said, Ishan, no wrong answer. But because of that, I almost think you have to give it to the guy who has a team that is playoff bound, because you have to ask yourself, without Acuna on the team, would the Braves actually be in the number one spot controlling their destiny in the National League East?
I'm not sure I totally endorse that as like an important criteria for Rookie of the Year. I feel like I'm more on board with that for MVP than for Rookie or Cy. But I do think it's a reasonable tiebreaker, and this is pretty close to a tie.
Yeah, well, I think the reason that it makes so yeah, I think you're right. In MVP, that is more germane to the discussion, but I think in this case, the success that a team has had is an indicator of the cumulative success of each of its players. And so that if a Rookie of the Year is on a winning team that's playoff bound, as opposed to a winning team or a team that's like hovering around 500 like the Nats, then it's probable that that Rookie of the Year has contributed in some key ways to the success of that team in ways that might not be entirely quantifiable or just wouldn't be quantified by the available statistics that we have. Does that make sense?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, a related point is that you might think that the player on the playoff bound team has had to perform under greater pressure.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, in the so-called clutch situations or like higher leverage scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, in other sports too, I don't think this really applies to baseball as much, where a lot of the things you're doing are pretty individual, cut and dry in terms of like catching a fly ball or when you're hitting
right.
The plate. But in other sports, you could definitely make the case that you have to fulfill a different role and your stats look different. Like in basketball or football, if you're on a winning team, you have like fewer shots or fewer targets as a receiver or whatever. And so you should account for that in the stats. But I don't think that argument I can't really think of a way that would hold in baseball.
Right. I'm going to go back, by the way, briefly just to touch on the Ohtani fielding point. I'm not sure where that Fangraphs number is coming from, because you're right, he has no appearances in the field that I can see. He only has the 10 games in which he started as a pitcher, and it looks like all of his chances resulted in putouts, and they were all routine in the 90-100% category for fielding chance. So I'm really not sure what that number is from. I think it's probably safe to assume, just based on small sample size, we can't judge anything about Ohtani's fielding ability. So
seems reasonable. And going back to the other thing about outfield defense between the Yankees and A's, it looks like they're all pretty average. The one guy I can't find the stats for some reason is Laureano, who, of course, center fielder for the A's. We've seen his crazy highlight, that 320-foot throw from left center field to first base straight on a line, on a fly.
That was awesome.
At Angel Stadium. And so I'm just going to go ahead without any data and say, based on that he's the best outfielder on either of those two teams. So advantage Oakland. They play in the bigger outfield in Oakland, and they have the best outfielder.
Love it. Yeah. Let's go with that. We're just about out of time here, guys, but this was a good discussion. Do you have anything else to add? Any big meta thoughts about the state of MLB today?
I think whenever we get to the Yelich-Baez discussion, or, you know, potentially some third player too, that'll be fun to have. You'll be surprised to find that I'm not as homeristic about it as you might expect.
Oh, okay. I will look forward to that discussion. Yeah, let's do that next week. Let's do an MVP discussion, and we'll cover NL and AL MVP, and maybe get into Cy Young stuff. Hand out some individual hardware as well, and then talk playoffs when we get there.
Sounds good.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for joining us. To our listeners, you can follow us at Zach Crippen, at Pete_LeCleed, and Ishan, I'm already forgetting your new Twitter handle, but it's no longer Should Have Kept JB.
Because they signed Luol Deng. It's now at Jimmy Lou and Taj.
Because the Timberwolves are basically becoming the old Bulls, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I'm an extremely nostalgic person.
I love it. So at Jimmy Lou and Taj, you can follow Ishan there. And check out the other shows on the Third String feed. You can hear Third String, the football show, and Takes to the Game, the basketball show. Until next time, thanks for listening to Third String Podcast.